Well, good afternoon. Welcome along. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, the part of faith explored every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio, when we bring Christians and non-Christians together for discussion and debate. If you want to find out more about the show, past programmes and lots of video resources and articles, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And today's discussion is going to be on suffering and God, very relevant in light of the viral video by Stephen Fry that came out about a week ago and has generated a lot of response online to it. In that, Stephen Fry, who's a well-known comedian, actor, television personality here in the UK, who's an atheist, describes what he'd say to God if he met him, and says why he'd call him a mean, stupid maniac of a God, given all the suffering in the world. Well, that's what we're going to be debating on the programme today, and I'm going to be introducing my guests in just a moment's time. They are Vince Vitale and Julian Baggini, as we look at suffering, especially from the perspective of a recent book that Vince Vitale has co-authored with Ravi Zacharias. But in response to Stephen Fry himself, I've actually thrown my hat into the ring, as it were, in terms of some of the video responses that are out there. And if you'd like to see my response to him directly, then do go to the Unbelievable website to watch that. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable, and you can see why I've taken a slightly different tack, I think, to some of the other responses, talking about a mutual literary hero of ours, Oscar Wilde. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable to watch that video. And indeed, you can watch a video of today's debate too. We decided to go all out with our discussion with Vince and Julian with me today. And so you can watch the video of our debate online as well at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Of course, lots of feedback and all the rest of it towards the end of today's programme. And straight after Unbelievable on Faith Explored, between 4 and 5, my special guest on the profile is R.T. Kendall, who's just an incredible storyteller, has had an amazing ministry here in the UK, even as an American on British shores in London. So hear that between 4 and 5. But for now, let's get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, and today on Unbelievable, we're discussing the problem of evil and asking, if there is a God, why does he allow suffering? Well, joining me as usual are a Christian and atheist guest. Vince Vitale is senior tutor at the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. His latest book, co-authored with Ravi Zacharias, is called Why Suffering, and aims to give a range of helpful responses to a question that simply never goes away. Here to dialogue with Vince is Julian Baggini. He's a philosopher and author who writes on a variety of subjects, including religious belief. As an atheist, he'll be explaining why the problem of suffering presents challenges for belief in God. So Vince and Julian, thank you for joining me on the programme today.
Thanks for having us.
We'll make sure to give links to your websites and that kind of thing later on in the programme. But just for the moment, we're tackling such a big issue today, and even in the time we've got, I'm sure we'll barely be able to do it justice. One that many people have debated down the years, down the centuries. But of course, in a sense, tragic stories never go away. They're always in our headlines, and it might be good to start by looking at one or two. Before we do that, let's have a quick introduction to you both. Vince, you're a philosopher, a Christian one. You work out in Oxford. How did you get into all that?
I didn't grow up in a Christian home myself. I grew up in sort of a culturally Catholic home. I guess if you had asked me if I was a Christian, I probably would have said yes, but it meant that was something I was born into as an Italian-American from New Jersey. I went to university, and I met some people who, when they said they were Christian, it seemed to mean something different. It seemed to have a practical, concrete relevance in their day-to-day life. That gave me pause, and I began a sort of search about what it was that these people believed. My assumption at the time was that in order to have faith, it had to be blind. You had to sort of park your brain on the side. I was pleasantly surprised to find people who didn't think that faith and reason had to be in tension. And it was partly through my interest in philosophy, which was already there, and digging deeper into some Christian philosophy, that I would say Christianity became a live option for me.
Sure.
It became something that I could see as plausible. And that opened the door to me taking Jesus seriously, taking his life seriously, starting to ask questions about whether or not that is someone who I wanted to follow. And then the philosophy just continued from there. through graduate studies, and I teach that now, and I particularly enjoy interacting with the sorts of questions that I was interacting with when I was seeking faith for the first time, and the questions that I continue to wrestle with.
You're not the first person to produce a book on suffering. It is a massive issue, as I said. What inspired you at this point to take that one on?
Yeah, fair point. Why another book on suffering when there are so many? I guess part of my response is Christian, atheist, everyone in between, I think it's something that we're all called to. We all need to take suffering seriously. We all need to take those who suffer seriously. So when I was deciding what to do in my graduate studies, both because of just that personal calling that dealing with suffering had to be a significant component of my life, and also knowing that this was one of the big hurdles for me to get over in order to take faith seriously, and for many who I've spoken with in order to take faith seriously, I wanted to do my PhD studies on a topic that I thought was relevant and was a question that actually a lot of people ask. Through that, I've come to think that there are a variety of helpful responses to the question, not a one-size-fits-all answer, but a number of helpful responses. And my co-author and I hoped that by putting a variety of the responses together in one book, having one chapter on each of a variety of responses, it could be a resource that would be helpful.
I mean, one of the chapters is based primarily on the work you did in your PhD. Now, I guess you have to boil it down a lot, if you like, to make it accessible for the average person.
Sure. That's true. But it's a great exercise. I think it was C.S. Lewis who said, and probably lots of other people as well, that if you can't distill your ideas to explain them in an accessible way to someone without expertise, then you haven't properly understood
it yourself.
Them. Exactly,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So that was a really good exercise to do that. And this is an approach which is on the newer side. There are hints of it in philosopher Leibniz. Robert Adams, who was one of my PhD supervisors, wrote about it to some extent in the 70s. And then 1970s, and then left some of the ideas, and basically in my PhD I picked up some of his ideas and took them further.
Well, it'll be good to explore that in some depth in the course of the program today as we get to talk about that in particular. But let's turn to our other guest today as well. Julian, thanks for joining me on the program today.
Thank you, Justin.
You have a website, microphilosophy.net, and when I visited it, there was just such a wide range of things you seem to talk about. Would you describe yourself as having any particular kind of focus in terms of your philosophical interests and that sort of thing?
Probably, some people would say not enough of a focus. I think there are unifying themes for me. I think that what it means to think clearly is something which is obviously kind of almost a meta-philosophical question. It's interesting how to live well, I think. Those two things, but they overspill, they cover so much. And I'm not an academic, and I think one reason for that is that to be an academic, you really do have to focus in, whereas my interest is in more of the connections between the things, the bigger picture. So, you know, maybe I have to sacrifice some depth for breadth. I don't know if that's true or not. If I do, I think some people have got to do that. There's a division of labour in philosophy, and I'm not one made for the deepest minds, perhaps.
You probably wouldn't, though, describe yourself to most people as an atheist philosopher. Presumably your philosophy isn't particularly linked to you being an atheist, but I guess it has some implications.
It informs it, absolutely it informs it. But to say I'm an atheist philosopher would make it sound as though everything I'm arguing for philosophically comes from an atheist basis, and it doesn't. I think I would imagine that a lot of the arguments I make, except really when they involve religion directly, are arguments that I would hope people could agree with or disagree with, and independently of their religious convictions. And also, this is an issue where I find myself very much kind of in opposition to the Christian mainstream, but I'm also very willing to acknowledge what contributions can be made, particularly to how we ought to live in religious traditions. I think that it's daft to just dispense with them. So, I'm an atheist, and I'm not afraid to say that. I'm not proud to say it's just what I am, but I wouldn't want everything that I wouldn't have to define everything about
sure,
me, you know.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Well, that's great. We're going to be talking about an issue that in many ways is a particular problem, you could say, for Christians and theists, But at the same time, it is something that anybody, whatever their beliefs, has to deal with, suffering. Mm. Obviously, our headlines are filled all the time with stories of one kind or another. And probably most recently, there's been obviously the tragic events in Paris, which saw the murder of several journalists, of Charlie Hebdo and police officers and so on. In a sense, that was an event that was perpetrated by people. It was a form of evil that you could say there was an intention behind. But then you do get other stories, and again, another similarly tragic case at the end of last year when in Glasgow a dustbin lorry mounted a curb, killing six people, three of whom were from the same family. And that, when I read that, made me think, gosh, it just seems so random. It seems so wasteful. Mm-hmm. Why? You know, and that is always the question you come back to, don't you? Where do you begin with that kind of thing, Vince, when someone is struggling, probably on a personal level most of the time, with a situation, a circumstance that's painful? I'm guessing you don't roll in straight away with your PhD thesis at that point.
Certainly not. I think that's the first thing I'd want to say. It's not always the time to address or to try to respond to the question, why? Why suffering? I have a very poignant example in my own life where my aunt was conveying to me some terrible suffering that she had been through, and I did jump in with some of my more abstract philosophical ideas. This was many years ago. And she listened to me patiently, and then she said, "Vince, that doesn't speak to me as a mother," which I have come to think was a very fair response, and I hope has helped me to listen a lot longer and to ask a lot more questions before I would think it would be even time to have a conversation about the question of why. And when I listen to events like this, I mean, one thing that's important to me is I think we need to say things like that are evil, that they're objectively evil, that they really are evil. And I hope that my Christian worldview and my understanding of God allows me to do that.
I see how that could easily be said of the Charlie Hebdo tragedy. In a sense, though, in what sense is a bin lorry crashing into people on the street at Christmas time evil? Is it simply just a tragic accident? I mean, do we ascribe evil in that case?
Sure. I think I would want to. I would want to use strong language there. I'd want to use strong language. And I think, you know, from my Christian point of view, not to say that there aren't other ways of talking about this, but from my Christian point of view, you know, each life is sacred. Mm. Each person is created in the image of God. Each person is loved by God. And so whatever explanation we give to the question of why, the fact that something sacred, a human person, has suffered or has been affected in that sort of way, I think we should say that that's evil. We should say that our starting point has to be that something is bad about that, and that's not ultimately what we should desire, and not ultimately what a God would want in the end.
Same question to you, Julian. When you are confronted with tragedies or people who are going through something, what's your response to them on a practical level?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult. I think it's very hard to say anything that can be of help to people. You know, if you say to people, it's going to be all right, for example, that can be so trite. I mean, you know, often even, for a start, that's not really ever really true, actually. Things are never all right again for people when they've been through these things. Things can get okay again, but things are never the same. But also it can seem not credible at the time. And, you know, I think that the most difficult thing, there's a kind of suffering of having to be around with someone who you love who is suffering and being unable to help them. Yeah. Ultimately, I think all you can do is, you know, be there for them. And it sounds so thin, but ultimately, that's the only thing you can do. They know that they're loved, that they have support, that you have their sympathy is with them. But you can't pretend you can take that pain away, and you can't pretend to explain it or justify it. And then people need in their own time to work through it in whatever way they do.
Do you ever go down the route, as an atheist, of trying to say, you're going to see why this, you know, there's a reason behind this.
No, I mean, you just can't go down that road. I don't think you can. And I think that's it's interesting how difficult it is. You say that people naturally ask why, and they do actually a lot of the time. And I'm always a bit baffled because I know it's possible to break that habit, because I think that if you get accustomed to a worldview in which you accept that, you know, things don't happen with an ultimate purpose, things just happen, you do stop asking why after a while, genuinely. So, you know, if I, you know, I haven't, I've been lucky so far, I haven't had a major disease, but I had a worrying diagnosis, well, worrying symptoms which weren't yet diagnosed. There's a potential of being something serious and life-threatening. And I didn't ask myself, why me? I thought it happened to other people. You know, of course it could happen. I kind of expect at some stage something really nasty to happen. So you can get out of that way of thinking, but the default for people is to want to know why and to think there must be a reason. And if that's what people are thinking, it can be very hard to say there's no why, it just happens.
Sure.
Yeah. I just wanted to pick up on the importance of just being there with someone and affirm that. I think that's one of the things, you know, from my Christian perspective, that's one of the things, and this is not a statement of its truth or its falsity, but it's one of the things I value about the Christian tradition in particular, is that if there's a God who actually has lived a human life and actually suffered and knows what suffering is, then for anyone who's suffering, I can say to them that they don't need to wonder whether there's someone who exists who understands what they're going through, or if there's someone who cares. And that's something that's attractive to me about my faith, that I don't think anyone ever has to go through suffering in isolation, and I can offer my faith and my God as someone who understands and who can be there amidst that. And I agree in a sense with what you said about it will never be all right. I want to be really careful, and I think you do too, to not say, well, it's not a big deal that you've gone through this terrible piece of suffering, or that's fine, but don't worry, you'll see eventually that that wasn't really evil, or anything along those lines. And yet at the same time, I hope that, because I do believe that there can be an afterlife, which can be great.
And you believe in that sense the why question is one that everyone should and can ask.
That it is one that we do naturally ask, which is not to say that we can't get to a point where we stop asking that in the same sort of regular way. But I had friends recently who went through a miscarriage, and for them that was quite devastating. The woman had to have surgery, lost a lot more blood than she should have. It was traumatic for them, and they are Christians, and they decided to name the baby Hope, because from their perspective, they really do believe that there's the possibility of being a family together with that child in heaven, which, again, is not an argument for the truth or the falsity of the Christian faith. But when we're talking about how do we respond to real-life suffering, it's something I really value about my tradition, that I can call it evil, but I can also say that there is real hope. And at the same time, I can say there is always someone who knows what you've been through.
I'm going to pick up on something you said there, because what's quite interesting is that I can see how what you're saying about if you believe that God is always there for you, that can be a kind of a comfort. But on the other hand, I think you'll agree with me on this, that there is a tendency for a lot of people to actually dismiss Christianity on that basis, that, oh, you know, you just got this comfort. And actually, it's a lot more complicated than that, isn't it? So first of all, it's at times like these that people go in different ways. And for some people, it's a crisis of faith. They lose someone. There seems to be no reason for it. They can't understand why their loving God would want it for them. And they really struggle with that. And that's one thing. And another thing is that no matter how profound people's faith are, you know, it doesn't stop it being really, really hard. And I think this is a very interesting point about this, because, you know, people often say there are no, you know, atheists in foxholes is the old phrase. But, you know, at the graveside, you know, there are very few people who act, as it were, as if they're 100% convinced that this is just a temporary separation and they're going to be together. You know, the separation feels very, very real. And there's not, you know, if you ever see someone with the blithe confidence, like smiling out, it's all right, we're going to see them soon. That's really weird and isn't actually
And isn't
typical.
What happens.
It isn't what
happens. No, absolutely. But I mean, there's a real struggle there, absolutely. You know, I've lost people I love. You've lost people you love, and I miss them. And yet, I have been at memorial services, funerals of Christian friends who believe with strong conviction that they're going to see this person again, and they're going to be in great friendship again. And it does look different. And you find both in full measure. You find the grief, but you also find a celebration.
You sort of write about this, interestingly, in terms of Jesus. There's the story of him raising Lazarus from the dead. And yet, one of the most famous verses in Scripture, Jesus wept. And you sort of say, well, why did Jesus weep if he knew he was about to raise his friend Lazarus?
Yep.
So, and draw out this point about that Jesus kind of understood the nature of the suffering we go through.
I think that's right. I think both can be there in full measure, that real weeping. And note there that Lazarus' sisters, Mary and Martha, are not very impressed that Jesus has come late and their brother has died before he gets there. And it could have been the time where Jesus says, well, here's why I had to wait. Here's my reasoning. Here's why suffering. He doesn't do that, which I think is a good model. He just weeps with them. But then also there is the celebration at the rising of Lazarus, and that pointing to the fact that there can be an afterlife and we can live together. With people.
There is a flip side to this, though, which I'd like to hear your thoughts on, which is that for a lot of Christians believe that as well as eternal salvation, there's eternal damnation. Now, and whenever I talk about this with Christians, they're obviously very careful to say that it's not for them to judge.
Sure.
So they will not have an opinion about that. It's not for them to say whether someone is going to go to hell, even though intellectually they believe that without having accepted Christ into your life, you won't go to heaven. But that means that there must be situations where you lose someone, where someone dies, and at the very least you have grave cause for concern. That person, you may not meet them again. It might be your mother, your brother, your father, your daughter, your son. And it's not just, it seems they magnify it. They haven't just suffered and died. They might be facing eternal torment. Isn't that far more discomforting than any comfort you could get that you're going to be reconciled with some people? In the afterlife.
Fair challenge. Very fair challenge. I think that I can always hold out hope for anyone who has died. I think that partly because I've seen in my own life, it's often been when people who I love have been closest to death. My dad has been close to death at times and hasn't passed on. But it's in those times that my assessment of the situation is that actually his kind of spiritual sensitivity is heightened in those times. We can give different explanations for that, but God is reaching out to him in an even stronger way in even those moments before he might die. So I never want to say that I can't have hope for someone that they could wind up in heaven. And in that sense, I think I can always kind of retain that hope. But there is that reality in the Christian faith, and different Christians think of this differently. Some think of this as an eternal conscious state. John Stott thought of it as an annihilationist view, which would be more perhaps like an atheist view where we cease to exist. But from my perspective, I think it is important that we don't take medieval paintings of fire and torture and just kind of put that onto Christianity as the assumed understanding of what hell would be like. My understanding of hell is that if a person in their heart doesn't want to be with God, God's not going to force someone to be with them. I think that would be a terrible state to be in, because I think we were made to be in strongest relationship with that person, God. But what exactly that state looks like, I don't presume to have a lot of knowledge about, but I see it as a place of choosing not to live in relationship with God, not as a place that God sort of sends you so that he can find the worst ways to torture you, but actually him allowing you to live with that choice.
I mean, does that help or not? So much. I don't know whether that kind of
softens the blow. Softens the blow if you don't believe that whatever hell is, it's a place where people are going to suffer in perpetuity. If it's some kind of annihilation, then that helps to a certain extent. But I still think it sort of it leaves a kind of a bitterness there, because, you know, even if it's just an absence from an eternal life, you know, in that eternity, you're going to have this awareness of this lost opportunity. And I guess, and the other thing that I have to say, though, that I find difficult listening to that is, you know, you say about it's choosing not to live with God. I mean, that really isn't how it feels. I mean, I actually get quite agitated when Christians describe atheists like myself as people who have are choosing to reject God or choosing to reject Christ. Because that's not how it seems. What it seems to us is we can't believe in God because it doesn't add up to us for one reason or another. Now, if that's because we're too stupid or blinded or whatever it might be to see it, that's one thing. But it's certainly not a choice. It's not a rejection of God. And so I do find it hard to see. I mean, we don't want to drift too much. I find it hard to see how God would.
I think that's fair. And I would just want to say that because of the way I understand God's character and his love for each person, that he would ensure that at some point, even if it is in those dying moments, he would ensure that each person does have an opportunity to choose him if that's what they would desire. What I wouldn't want to say is, Julian, you have had the choice, and it's your fault for not making that decision at this point. Only God knows our stories and how he's reaching out to us and when that time is.
We are just going to have to go to a break. And when we come back, I'd like to specifically tackle at least one or two of the ways in which you do address the issue of why suffering in the book. So we're talking about suffering on the programme today. I'm Justin Brierley. My guests today on Unbelievable are Vince Vitale from the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. Find out more about him and the centre at theocker.org. And his latest book, co-authored with Ravi Zacharias, is called Why Suffering, aiming to give a range of helpful responses to this question about suffering, why God allows it, that simply never goes away. Julian Bagini is my other guest. He's an atheist philosopher. You can find out more about him at microphilosophy.net, and he's asking some of the challenging questions today on the programme that aims to get you thinking. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
With the film version of best-selling erotic novel 50 Shades of Grey set to hit UK cinemas, in the latest magazine we examine the new permissiveness in pornography. Labour leader Ed Miliband sits down to talk to us about church, and we find out why an evangelical church in Cairo has had a miraculous role in healing Egypt's recent political turmoil. All that, plus interviews, news, reviews, and your favourite column.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of Unbelievable. Today's discussion on evil, suffering and God between Vince Vitale and Julian Bagini, very relevant in light of that recent video that went viral of Stephen Fry explaining what he'd say to God as an atheist. And if you want to watch today's video, it's online as well. We filmed this discussion between Julian and Vince and myself. So that's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Go to the videos section there to access the video, plus my response video to Stephen Fry as well, if you're interested in seeing that. We're going to be hearing some of your feedback to recent additions to the programme later on in the show. Lots of response to the John Loftus versus David Marshall show, where we looked at the outsider test for faith 2 weeks in a row. That's generated a lot of interest online, so I'll be reading some of the responses to that, including responses from John Loftus and David Marshall. So look out for that a bit later on in the programme. Right now, into the second part of today's discussion.
Well, welcome back to the programme. On Unbelievable today, we're discussing the problem of evil. It's the question that never really goes away as we ask, if there is a God, why does he allow suffering? Vince Vitale joins me on the programme, senior tutor at the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, and his latest book, co-authored with Ravi Zacharias, is called Why Suffering? He aims to give a range of helpful responses to the question, and we're going to be looking at one or two of those in the time remaining on the programme today. Julian Bagini, also with us, he's asking the hard questions. He's a philosopher and author, writes on a variety of subjects. You can check out his work at microphilosophy.net. And as an atheist, he's been explaining why he believes the problem of suffering is a challenge for believing in God. Perhaps, Vince, it would be good, we don't have time to cover all of the ways in which you approach the issue of suffering in the book. But in particular, I wanted to at least talk about the work you've put into this at an academic level and now, as it were, presented in a way that's accessible in the book. You've called the chapter The Response of Grace. Do you want to just briefly walk us through what this particular response to why God might allow suffering is?
Sure. Here's the general idea, and I take this not to be a sufficient response in and of itself, but a component of a helpful response. I think oftentimes when we think about this challenge of suffering, we can tend to picture ourselves or those we love in this world with all of its suffering. Then we can picture ourselves in a very different world with far less suffering or with no suffering. And then we might think to ourselves, we might wonder, if there is a God, why wouldn't he have created me in this world with far less suffering rather than in our current world and all of its suffering? I think that's a reasonable thought, but I think it's a thought that relies on a philosophical mistake, because it relies on the assumption that it would still be us, it would still be you and me as the individuals that we are in that very different world. And I don't think that's the case. I tell a story in the book of my parents on their second date, and they're standing on the Brooklyn Bridge. My dad notices a ring on my mom's finger, and he asks about it. And she says, oh, that's just some ring one of my old boyfriends gave to me. I just wear it because I think it looks nice. He says, oh, it is nice. Let me see it. She takes it off and hands it to him. And my dad throws it off the bridge and watches it sink to the bottom of the East River. The question I draw out of that is, my mom happened to love that. Okay, I think that was the clinching moment for her. But if she hadn't, if she had decided,
what a jerk.
What a jerk. I better run back with the old boyfriend instead. What would that have meant for me? And I might be tempted to think, oh, that might have been better for me. The other guy might have been taller. He might have been more athletic. He might have been better looking. He might have had more money. But if I start to think down those lines, I think I'm thinking in the wrong way. If my mom had wound up with the other guy rather than my dad, it's not me who would have come to exist. Maybe some other child would have come to exist. Maybe he would have been taller and had more money. But it wouldn't have been me, because part, at least, of what makes me who I am is my origin. The parents that I have, the sperm and egg that I came from, the combination of genes that's true of me. And I think sometimes when we think about the problem of suffering, something similar can be going on. We picture one world with us in it. We picture a very different world that we would have liked to have come to exist in. And we don't think about the assumption there that it would still be me in that world. I then couple that idea with the question, what if it's the case that God really likes the idea of each of us existing? What if it's the case that God actually loves each individual person? What if he created the sort of world that would allow us to come to exist because he wanted us to exist, because he desired to invite us into relationship with
himself? But for you to exist as Vince Vitale required, probably, in your parents' lives and their grandparents' lives and great-grandparents' lives, a fair bit of suffering that kind of created the kinds of events that led to your parents meeting and you sitting here.
That's right. And certainly if whether or not my dad throws a ring off of a bridge can affect who comes to exist, then changing big things about the universe such that it would be one that wouldn't have the threats to natural disaster or the possibilities of evil as a product of free will would certainly be enough to say that we wouldn't come to exist or perhaps even beings of our type.
And in a sense, the if you like, God is willing to allow that the level of suffering that we do therefore experience and see and evil and so on in the universe, because he thinks the end product, i.e. you and me and Julian, is worth it in the end.
Yeah, not because he desires the evil and the suffering. And I want to be careful here not to portray this approach as an overly instrumentalist one, where it's kind of, is this suffering allowable for that end?
Yeah.
I don't think of this so much as a greater goods approach, where we say, here's the evil and suffering. Does the good outweigh the evil and suffering? I think of it more of a love for individual persons approach. I don't think the primary question in God's mind is one of a calculation of whether or not we get overall maximal value or greater world value on this approach than on that approach. I see God as aimed for beings like us, and perhaps also the individuals that come to exist, and creating out of love for those. That doesn't mean that it's an easy choice, just like I don't think it's an easy choice for human parents to decide to have a child. You're doing something that you know full well, if you do that willfully, is going to result in serious suffering, because any child, even with the most favorable life, will undergo serious suffering and ultimately one day death. So you're doing something, even as a human parent, that you know is going to result in serious suffering and in death. But we think that it could be still an act of love or even an act of courage if it's done out of love for that child, with a commitment to do everything you can for that child, with a commitment to make sacrifices for that child. And so I want to think about God in a way that's sort of analogous there.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. Okay, well, you got here in a sense what sometimes is technically termed a theodicy, a way of explaining why there might be suffering, why God might allow that because of some other purpose, greater purpose, you know. What do you make of this particular one?
Well, I think there are several problems with it. I mean, one is I think Vince is exactly right that in a way to wish for a universe in which there was no suffering would be to wish yourself out of existence. But that doesn't solve the problem, actually. What it merely shows is that, you know, actually, if you ask the question, why did God... You can think intellectually it would have been better for God to have created a world with no suffering or less suffering. That would have been better. Now, I wouldn't wish that for myself, because it meant I wouldn't exist, but it would still be better. So, you know, one can judge that it would be better without suffering while acknowledging that would mean not you, right? But the second thing is that the parental analogy is an interesting one, but I don't think it works for what you're saying, because, okay, let's take your parents. You say a parent loves their child, and that's why they bring them into the world. But until that particular child has come into the world, your mum did not love you before you were born. If the night you were conceived, one of them had a terrible headache and a different child had been conceived the next day, they would have loved that other child equally as much. Now, similarly, from God's point of view, it seems if you believe that God loves each and every one of us, and he loves us for who we are as individuals, not just because we're carriers of... That might all be true, but until anyone comes into existence, the range of possible people who could have come into the existence is infinite. And it would seem weird to me to think that, you know, God had to arrange things in this way, because in his plan, he wanted Vince, Julian and Justin to come into the world, as opposed to any number of other possible people who would have come into the world and would have been just as lovable. Because that would be the point. Your idea of God and an idea of a parent is not that they create children or human beings and they only love the ones that fit their pre-existing template of who they are. They love them whoever they are. So I can't really see how this explanation actually explains why
how
God
it is
did
analogous.
Good challenges. I don't want to commit myself to saying this is the only universe God has created. So maybe it is the case that God has created those other universes that would have been better in some objective sense and would have included other people. All I want to say is that it's not clear to me that God has shown he's done something wrong if he also creates our universe and the individuals that are included in this universe. If we think to ourselves, God has wronged me by creating a universe like this, I think that's at least a more complicated question than it initially seems like. If I wouldn't have existed otherwise, and if I'm offered a life that is good on the whole. But I agree that there's no reason to think God wouldn't have loved other beings, other types of beings, or even other beings like human persons who are different individuals. And I have no problem with speculating that God could have created lots of universes with lots of different types of individuals as well.
Does that help?
Well, it kind of helps, but I don't know. To me, it seems to have undercut the force of the theodicy, because unless there's some, you know, the argument seems to rest on the thought that there's something important that we, the people who happened to have come into existence, came into existence, and that that could only have happened if everything else had been true, including suffering. And I'm not sure what you said there really deals with that problem.
So I'm happy to defend that a little bit as well. All I feel I want to say and need to say is that however many types of beings God has decided to create, and I don't think he would have an obligation to create every single kind, but whichever ones he created them out of love for the individuals who came into existence. I think that's all that I need to say on that point. And as long as he does that, I think I'm okay with the way I'm understanding it. It's not the case that God would have wronged any of the beings who he didn't decide to create, right? Because they never come to exist. So it's not like they've been harmed or wronged by God making a decision not to create them or not to create them at a certain time. But whether he's created just us and this universe or whether he's created many universes with lots of individuals, I want to say that he's done so because he desired that individual, those individual persons.
And right, those specific people, as opposed to it could have been.
Well,
any,
that's a strange thought.
Yeah.
I think,
that's a good challenge. And I'm happy to think about the approach in two different ways. It could be the case that God is aiming very specifically for individuals, but if you're someone who believes in free will, and if you're someone who doesn't believe in Molinism, meaning if you're someone who doesn't believe that before creation, God would know how every free person would act in any situation he could put them in, then even if God could know everything from an outside of time perspective, the way that he knows certain things in the future is because they actually happen. And it runs from the thing actually happening to God knowing it. If that's the case, then that knowledge of how we act freely in the future is not knowledge, even if God has it, that he would take into account when creating. On that version of this approach, what I'm wanting to say is that God could still aim for beings like us. Even if he's not aiming for the specific individual, he's aiming for beings like us. And I think that goes back to Julian's point about human procreation, having a child. When you have a child, you don't know that you're going to get Julian or Justin. You know that you're going to get your first child or your second child, and you have a commitment to love whoever it is that is specifically produced. You can think about this approach in that way, where God is creating an environment that allows certain types of beings to come into existence with a commitment to love whichever individuals happen to come into existence.
Yeah, but for me, that just leaves the basic puzzle intact, because it seems to me that I can imagine the puzzle then becomes, okay, God wants to create creatures something like us. Now, what do we mean by that? Creatures capable of loving him, sharing in eternity with him in some way, capable of learning, free will, etc., etc. So he wanted to create people like us. The puzzle seems to be that surely he could have created such people in such ways that didn't provide for as much sort of almost, it seems like, egregious suffering in the world. I mean, because these
gratuitous
things are gratuitous almost, gratuitous, because, you know, it seems that you wouldn't have to go too far. I mean, so for example, strange with a slightly different justification, there's the idea that, you know, we have to learn, we have to suffer in order to learn and so forth.
The sort of soul-making theology.
Yeah, but, you know, the obvious problem with that is, well, okay, true, but actually what we have to learn, some things we don't have to learn, some things we learn easily. Sometimes, you know, you can learn by a very small experience. Why did God make us such bad learners, you know, that we really needed all this awful suffering in order to learn the important things about love? Yeah. Now, of course, you'll come back, you'll have answers to those kind of things. So what I'm saying is you're back to those questions.
Yes.
The basic problem still seems to be there, despite what you've said about God's desire to create creatures like us and maybe the consequences.
And I think that God's love for us might be much more specific than just beings that could relate to him, beings that are intelligent. God could create lots of other types of beings like that, beings that wouldn't necessitate some of the sorts of sufferings that that exist in the world. And perhaps he has. I just want to claim that he's also created us. And maybe what he really loves about us is quite specific. Maybe it has specifics to do with our psychology and our biology and the narrative of the human race's history as well. It might be quite a specific love that he has. So the soul-making approach is an interesting one as well, this idea of...
And this is covered to some extent in the book as well.
It's covered to some extent.
Way of thinking. Just kind of, Julian sketched it out very briefly, but yeah, just maybe elucidate it a bit as to what this particular approach to the issue is.
It's covered to some extent in the book, and again, I think it doesn't stand on its own, but I think it can be one of a number of approaches which is helpful. You can see the environment as including different types of evil, but sometimes different types of evils that would be necessary in order for certain types of goods, especially the sorts of goods that form our character and can produce meaning in our lives.
Because it's hard to be compassionate if you don't have any cause to be generous or to share something.
Nothing to be compassionate about. It's not clear you can display courage if there's never a genuinely dangerous situation in which you would display courage. One way that I sometimes like to think about this approach is to ask people to think of two or three of the greatest lives that they think have ever been lived in their estimation, and then to try to subtract from those lives all of the suffering, or even a significant amount of the suffering that they responded to, the injustice that they fought against, the suffering that formed their culture and their character. And what happens quite quickly is that all of a sudden those lives don't look anything like the lives that we were initially...
That we're so inspired by.
So inspired by. So that's the sort of general approach there. And I find that compelling to an extent. But I don't think that the bar can be that for any piece of suffering that we point to, I as a Christian should be able to say, and the soul-making value of that is, or and the reason for that is. All the time, parents might have reasons for allowing a child to undergo something. A parent decides to move the family from one city to another. The child experiences that as genuinely horrible. It may genuinely be very difficult for the child. It doesn't mean that the parents couldn't have had good reasons to do that or even be doing that for the child's sake. In my own life, what I find is that when I look back on suffering in my life, for some of it, I'm able to say, you know what, that made no sense at the time, but now I can understand
An atheist could easily say the same. Of course, we can see the ways in which some hardships and suffering can develop our character in positive ways and looking back and so on. But you wouldn't ascribe it to therefore being a justification in a...
And it also seems to be... Well, it seems very unfair and excessive. So, for example, I mean, there are some examples we could point to which, you know, the suffering was just dreadful. You're talking about, you know, the killers who sort of tortured horribly their victims before they killed them and so forth. Now, you ask yourself the question, you know, why on earth could that possibly have been necessary, given the fact that if we're going to have the general idea that we need to have suffering in order to respond with compassion, well, most of us don't have to be confronted with that degree of suffering to learn. So clearly, there's not a general principle, no, we really must have the most awful suffering, otherwise no one can learn. Most of us don't. These seem to be, you know, excessive cases where it's like completely over the top.
But in that particular case, I guess Vince might want to bring in another theodicy, that free will, you know, as someone who is carrying out such a murderous, torturous act.
Well,
But the
problem there is that, I mean, that seems odd again, because whatever free will means, it's clearly a capacity. The capacity to free will is got to be something that people vary in their ability to exercise. You know, psychopaths and sociopaths, they do not... There's no credible account of free will which can say, no, those people had exactly the same degree of free will as an ordinary person. They have some, you know, major flaw, and that is a flaw which has emerged in the natural world which, if you're Christian, God has created. So, again, if you want to allow for free will, that doesn't explain why a heck of a lot of cases which go way beyond what is needed in order for people to exercise their free will. And in the case of, like, you know, people with psychopaths and so forth, it seems those individuals themselves have got some kind of free will deficiency and problem.
They're not. Yeah, it's not so much free will as they're mentally ill or whatever is going on.
I think it's important, you know, from my perspective, that there is, although I completely agree that, you know, suffering often seems excessive, and that there are certain approaches which I would particularly not want to say this is a good approach for that type of suffering. I would not want to say that, oh, the world is a classroom that we're learning through, and someone had to go through truly horrendous suffering in order to learn. There are certain ways that are appropriate to teach someone, and there are certain ways which are not. So I wouldn't want to apply each approach to each type of case. It's important to me on my beliefs that there is a limit to the extent to which we are, in a sense, required to be in this state of suffering, that it lasts for a certain amount of time, that there is a certain pain threshold after which our bodies turn off, that to not in any way to underestimate the degree of suffering that is a reality, but it's important to me also that there are limits that are placed on that. And what I find when I look back on my life, and I think this is what I would expect to find, is that I look back on some suffering and I say, okay, yes, I can, at the time that seemed utterly pointless and terrible, I can now look back on that and see how there's been some meaning that has been made out of that. It just doesn't necessarily mean that God determined it for that reason. It could have been a result of free will, but it could be why God might have allowed it. But then there are other things I look back on in my life, and I still just say, that seems utterly pointless. Mm. That seems terrible and utterly pointless, and I have no idea why God would allow that. But as I get older, hopefully as I get more mature, I'm generally able to reflect back, and little by little, more of that I can find meaning in. And so if that's the case, and if God's much more knowledgeable than I am, maybe that's what I should expect to find. I mean, see the connections with some suffering, but not with all of it.
If I could jump in and ask you at this point, Julian, the subtitle for the book is Finding Meaning and Comfort When Life Doesn't Make Sense. As an atheist, do you talk about meaning in the context of suffering? Because, or is that sort of out of bounds in the same way that you say the why question kind of has to be dispensed with at some level?
Well,
Do you have to just accept, in a sense, that evil and suffering don't really have any meaning?
Well, you do, in a sense. I mean, you know, meaning is an interesting word. One has to unpack it. But in terms of purpose, then no, that's end of story. The standard kind of atheist answer on meaning is, and the one I'd agree with, is that we can find meaning in the world, but in a sense, we kind of have to create it. And that's not just a sort of like a whimsical individual thing. We find it collectively as well, and we find it in things that are seen to be good and other people also believe are good. So it's not just you can decide anything's meaningful and anything isn't, but we have to kind of create it in some way. And, you know, so in that sense, suffering becomes a challenge. You either have to sort of like deal with it in a way that you can get over it and in that sense, you know, turn it into a meaningful experience, or not. Point is, and this is the hard side of atheism, which I think some atheists don't want to acknowledge. They want to say that no, everything's left lovely in the garden. Is that sometimes there really is no meaning to be found? Although, actually, interestingly enough, you know, even Vince says he can't see the meaning. And
sure.
So, from a practical point of view, we're in the same boat a lot of the time. Vince thinks there's a meaning, he can't see it. We don't think there's a meaning, and we can't see it.
Sure.
Sometimes, though, you know, things go wrong, and, you know, you're talking about looking back of your life, but, you know, we're here as the survivors. You know, there are people who can't deal with the suffering, who take their own lives, or who go under in some other way. And, you know, the difficult pill of the atheist worldview is to accept that, you know, for some lives there is pain and there is suffering and there is no redemption. That is a deep, dark fact about the universe which we have to accept. That is not necessarily easy to do. But the fact that it's difficult to accept it, from the atheist point of view, is not a reason in itself not to accept it. The atheist would say, we have to just be honest and accept that there are awful things about the universe, and they just are.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we're going to go to a quick break now. Vince and Julian are back with me to conclude the discussion in part three of today's programme. And we'll be hearing your feedback, your reactions to the programmes between John Loftus and David Marshall on the Outsider Test for Faith in just a moment's time in the third part of this week's programme. Welcome back to part three of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon on Premier Christian Radio. And don't forget that Faith Explored is available both here on the radio, but also we do a sort of a version of it on the magazine that I edit, Premier Christianity. And if you want to get hold of the latest copy of the magazine, you can find articles from it and a free sample copy available from the website. That's premierchristianity.com. Now, coming up later this afternoon, between 4 and 5, my guest is Artie Kendall for The Profile. He's well-known evangelical Christian, church leader, preacher and author. And he tells me all about his life and ministry, some amazing stories he's got to share. And you can actually read that as well in the pages of the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. So if you want to get hold of that and read it for yourself, premierchristianity.com/freesample to avail yourself of that. But he's my guest between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. Paula Gooder is joining me on the show next week here on Unbelievable. If you're not familiar with her name, Paula is very much a rising star in New Testament theology circles. I described her as the female Tom Wright last week, and if that's not too patronising, and said perhaps we should also call Tom Wright the male Paula Gooder. But Paula is a great communicator. Her specialism is the New Testament. She's a speaker at this year's Spring Harvest, and she's going to be coming on the programme to take a variety of theological questions. So not too late to add yours to the mix if you want to send me a question for Paula about the New Testament, about theology. Feel free to email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And thanks to those who've already sent in their suggestions as well. Or tweet me at unbelievablejb or facebook.com/unbelievablejb to get in touch with me via the social media ways. And we'll be putting as many of your questions to Paula on next week's programme as we can. So look out for that. At the same time next week, Paula Gooder joins me to talk about the New Testament. Just another thing I should mention, I did mention it a few weeks ago on the programme, but I've been having quite a few people get in touch asking, when's the Unbelievable Conference happening, Justin, for 2015? And I'm going to have to repeat, unfortunately, what I said last time. We're not actually going to be having an Unbelievable Conference this year. A variety of reasons for that decision, but we will be coming back strong in 2016 with another Unbelievable Conference, and hoping a bit later on in the year to have some kind of a public debate of some kind going on. But watch out for details of that. But we will post a note on our website about the fact that there's no conference this year, just because of the volume of people who have been getting in touch asking when it's going to be happening, and perhaps that'll make it a bit clearer. But in the meantime, thanks for your support of Unbelievable. Really pleased with all the things that we've got lined up for the coming year in terms of shows and the like. But for the moment, let's get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
For you, as much as the problem of suffering does present a serious challenge to Christianity, Vince, what do you make of, as it were, where an atheist goes when it comes to suffering? Is it easier for an atheist, or at some level, it could be said, and I've heard other people say, in a sense, I'd rather be confused about what God's up to when it comes to suffering, rather than thinking there really just isn't any meaning and we're just floating and it's all random at the end of the day. That's not what you've said, but sure. That's what some people sort of do say.
Yeah, I mean, I take great comfort in the hope that I think I can find in a loving God existing and in the possibility of an afterlife where people can have a great eternal life. I pretty recently had an experience with my best friend's father where he was on his deathbed. My best friend asked me to go and speak with him. His understanding, he did believe that there was a God of some sort, but his understanding of what it meant to be right with God was try to do more good than bad. If you've done enough good, at the end of the day, you're going to go to a good place. If you haven't, you know, then you're in trouble. And he reflected back on his life and was coming to the conclusion that he was in trouble. And, you know, I was so thankful to be able to sit there and think, no, hope is not lost, even on this person who is just, you know, days from their death. And I can say, not only does a God exist, but a God who is not like a Santa Claus or a Father Christmas who's just counting your goods and your bads, a God who loves you more unconditionally for that. From my Christian perspective, a God who did himself everything that was necessary in order for you to be right with him, not relying on you to be able to do enough to make yourself right with him. And so from that perspective, I think that's really significant, that, you know, that I never feel like there's a point at which someone is beyond hope, and that that's something that that I can share someone, even if it is in their final days. I think that's significant. I mean, another question I'd want to raise, I'd be interested to hear you talk about this, Julian, from the atheist perspective, is that, because I think we'd agree, we need to be able to say when we, especially when we see horrors, that is evil. That is objectively evil. Do you think that there's a challenge to saying that from an atheistic perspective? I have my sort of, you know, way of saying of that I believe I can say that because I think at the center of all reality is a moral being who's loving and good, and evil are things that contradict that. Is that a challenge for atheism, or do you think that there's a good way to respond to that?
Is it a challenge that, you know, that you're suggesting that there might be a problem for atheists being able to say that is wrong, that is bad?
I'm wondering how...
Identifying that something is evil
I don't actually see the problem. I think if you set up... Well, this is quite a complex issue in many ways. I'd appreciate
for the final 5 minutes.
If you set up the idea of objective evil in a particular way, that might become problematic. But you see, I think fundamentally, going back to this classic thing, going back to Plato, the Euthyphro dilemma, I do think that's pretty clear here. I don't think there's a straightforward way in which accepting a theistic universe gives you something fundamentally that the atheists don't. And here's why, because the old problem is you believe in a good God at the centre of the universe, this moral being at the core. But you have to ask the question, what makes this God good? Now, if you say, well, you know, God, whatever, God is good because God is God and he decides what's good. Well, that seems to be the wrong answer. Because I don't think there are many Christians, there might be some, I mean, you know, it's a very diverse world, who would say, yeah, you know what, God could have written those Ten Commandments differently, so they're the exact opposite. If God had said adultery is right, adultery would have been right, full stop. That's not the way most people think about it. Most people say, no, adultery is wrong, and God says it's wrong because it's wrong.
Yeah.
And that opens up this gap, you see, between there's something about the concept, the idea of goodness, which seems to stand by itself. What enables you to say God is good is because the two things don't mean exactly the same thing. Even though, as a matter of, in other ways, you might say God might be the source of all goodness, the cause of all goodness, what it means to be good is got to be understood in a way which is independent of God. Now, you can understand that in many ways. You could understand it in a way which makes it completely objective in some way. You could understand it in other ways which don't require it to stand outside of time in some way. Whichever way you do it, I think, you know, the same kind of thing is open to you as an atheist or as a religious believer.
I think you're right. At some point, anyone hits explanatory bedrock, right? We can keep saying why, and at some point each of us is going to stop. I'm going to stop with God's nature and say that's just how God's nature is. You're going to stop at something as well. I think what's important from my perspective is that to stop with something stable, that there's a sort of stability to morality if I ground it in God's nature and if God's a necessary being. And sometimes what I find challenging is thinking of what the naturalistic alternatives are that have the sort of stability about morality that I think we want to say is true when we claim that is objectively evil and would be in any situation.
We've opened up a big can of worms.
Yeah.
with very short period to go on the show and something that we've addressed in other shows as well and so on. And I think Euthyphro's dilemma is essentially what you've elucidated there, Julian. But it is an interesting one. And one I think you tackle a little bit at the start of the book, Vince, along with Ravi, this question of what is suffering? You know, is there an objective realm of evil and so on? But it's been really interesting. Great to have you both on the programme today. A serious subject, but I really appreciated the way in which you've both thought about it and talked it through in a very gracious way. Do you think you'll ever write on this particular subject? Maybe you have.
I've done short things in introductory books. So I'm not sure that it's something I'd really turn to. But if I've got time, I must say I struggle with the issue because for me there's something about theodicy which I find kind of troubling. In all the people I interviewed for the Philosopher's Magazine, the only time I interviewed someone and I had a kind of almost a visceral kind of reaction against them was a well-known theologian who was explaining away evil. And it seems to me that Vincent said this at various points, I actually think the only honest way to deal with suffering as a Christian is to say that in some way it's got to be for the greater good.
Right.
But it is utterly mysterious how it is. I think the moment you try and make sense of it, you risk sort of
sounding crass.
Crass and yeah, almost obscene at times, you know.
Yeah.
And I so in that sense, I don't think it is a decisive objection against religion. But I think the best response is not to try and explain it, but to truly embrace the idea that if there is a God, then this God is in lots of ways way beyond our comprehension, and we should accept that mystery. The problem is that, as a matter of fact, people only tend to embrace the mystery when they reach the difficulties in their own position. I think that there should be... I think the most honest way to approach belief is to accept a lot more mystery, actually.
Yeah. One of the ways in which I try to move away from a greater goods approach a bit, I think, in part for some of the reasons that you've given, is by trying to focus on people, saying that ultimately, if I believe in a loving God, his central concern has to be about people, about individuals, and about love for them, not about these questions of can I get more generic or global or maximal value this way.
And inevitably, as we said at the beginning, a theodicy is not what someone in suffering usually needs at the moment they're suffering. But it's been really interesting to have you both on the programme. Thank you very much, Julian and Vince, for being with me. If you want to find out more about both my guests, theocca.org for Vince Vitali. Julian Bagini is at microphilosophy.net. I'll make sure to post some links to books and further resources if you want to find out more. In the meantime, thank you very much for joining me on the show today, Julian and Vince.
Thank you both.
Thanks a lot.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you want to get in touch about today's programme, as ever, the ways to do that are unbelievable@premier.org.uk. That's the email address, and I'll be reading some of your emails to the most recent editions of the programme in a moment's time. You can also send me your thoughts via Twitter and Facebook. @unbelievablejb is my Twitter handle. Facebook.com/unbelievablejb is the Facebook page of this programme. Not to be confused with the group. There is an Unbelievable group which you can apply to join. It's actually a closed group and you sort of have to ask to join and you'll then get added. That's where a lot more of the debate and discussion stuff goes, and all the members of that group can start the conversations there and that kind of thing. It's a place where, you know, the exchange of views is frank sometimes, to the point of sometimes being insulting, it's probably fair to say. But nonetheless, most of the time it stays in order. And if you do fancy that kind of thing, that's the place to go. Now, someone who's a regular contributor there, having been a guest on the programme last year, is Ed Atkinson, who wants to alert us to the fact that a new Facebook group that he's created alongside another person is now in existence. It's called Ex-Christian Atheist Still Married to Believers, and they're welcoming members. That's the category that Ed himself falls into, an ex-Christian atheist still married to a believer. And he believes that there's lots of other people who are probably in the same position. And if you'd like a support group, a place for discussion about that, then why not look it up on Facebook? So again, that's Ex-Christian Atheist Still Married to Believers, a new Facebook group that you may want to join if you're interested. Let's go to some of your feedback to last week's programme. Oh, before I do that, just a quick reminder as well, before we completely lose the thread of talking about suffering and so on, that video response of mine to Stephen Fry is available now to view, both on YouTube and on the Premier TV player at the website of this show, premierchristianradio.com/ unbelievable. So look out for that. So yes, responses though to last week's programme and the week before, two editions of the programme given over to looking at the outsider test for faith. That's what John Loftus calls his particular argument against Christianity, indeed all religions. And he was on with David Marshall, who's written a book, Why Jesus Passes the Outsider Test. Well, they had a pretty full-on debate for 2 weeks running. And there was a lot of online response to this as well, including from John and David themselves. In fact, at one point on his blog, Debunking Christianity, John posted that he didn't feel I'd been entirely fair in terms of my moderation of the discussion. So he wrote this, Justin hosts the very popular Christian podcast Unbelievable. He's an amicable guy, but he's clearly not as neutral or objective an interviewer as he portrays himself. Before agreeing to have this discussion with David Marshall, who'd written a book on the Outsider Test for Faith, I had insisted on equal time. However, it was a bit annoying up until the 28-minute mark to sit and listen to so much drivel without a good chance to respond. So when I was given a chance to speak at length, I came up with 5 objections to what was being said. Justin subsequently took each one of my objections and had a discussion about them. This isn't what he did when Marshall spoke. There were many times in the interview where Marshall said things I wanted to respond to, but I wasn't given the same chance. So John had a bit of a complaint on his blog about that and posted it up on the Facebook page as well. I've responded to that saying, and I'll just read my response to John. Thanks for leaving your thoughts about this show, John. As you might anticipate, I respectfully disagree with your view of how it was moderated. I haven't totted up exactly how much time you each had. I don't sit with a stopwatch with these things. I just try to ensure both sides have adequate representation. And of course, you've been on the show before, John, a few times, so regular listeners might already be familiar with the Outsider Test for Faith anyway. But inevitably, as David Marshall was the one with a book out and an argument to defend, it was necessary to give him time to set that up initially, though it wasn't as if you actually had no input for the first 28 minutes, which is a bit what the post makes it sound like. There was certainly some to and fro between you. And thereafter, you did offer several objections to David, and it seemed to make sense to me to simply tackle each one again, with opportunity for to and fro discussion in each instance. And if you didn't feel like you were given opportunity to come back on things that David said, I am sorry about that. But I personally felt it was a fair exchange. And of course, you had a second bite to the cherry as well with show two. But anyway, there you go. Can't please everyone all the time with these things. Let's look at some of the feedback that came in to the show. Firstly, some of the responses underneath the online version of the show at the web page, where you can directly respond to the show, leave your comments underneath the latest edition of the programme. So Michael Brady, who's a regular contributor there, said, I was surprised to hear that only Islam and Marxism were spread by the sword, according to David Marshall. The notion that Christianity wasn't introduced by and then defended with force is silly on its face. For much of its history, the church has been the power behind, a partner in, or the direct beneficiary of European imperialism and colonialism. Well, David Marshall himself got on to a line there to respond to you. I'm just going to there were a number of things mentioned, but I'll just read the part that's relevant. He says, as for spreading by the sword, let me repeat what I said above. As I said, during the debate, I analysed the spread of Christianity in 12 different periods. Now, he goes into detail on his Christ the Tao blog about that. But you say, David, so that part of my claim is clearly correct. Sometimes force was used, but not usually, and that more often to defend, not to expand, whereas Islam conquered vast reaches of territory through armed violence. Syria, Egypt, North Africa, Spain, much of the Byzantine Empire, Pakistan, India, parts of Indonesia. That's called spreading by the sword. Conversion wasn't always encouraged, but preferential treatment and discrimination enforced by the sword, plus lack of freedom to convert back on pain of death, ensured the gradual Islamification of conquered territory. Communism also obviously spread in much the same way. Those citizens were not allowed to not convert in more cases. I know that history quite well, as he did a BA on it. But in any case, if you want to read David Marshall's full response to that, the spread of Christianity in 12 different periods and why he doesn't believe it is spread by the sword, christthetao.blogspot.com for that. I had a physical letter come through my mailbox this last week in response to those shows. Someone actually sat down, wrote a letter and posted it off to me. This is, I think, S.P. Jackson, who says, it would have been helpful had John Loftus, your atheist, described in some detail his outsider test, based on what he described as methodological naturalism. This appears to be taking aspects of religions which are claimed to be supernatural in nature and finding naturalistic explanations for them. This seems to me to have two weaknesses. The first is, he appears to assume that all aspects can be explained naturally. The second relates to the confidence which can be ascribed to any supposed natural explanation. A natural explanation related to past events cannot be tested by reproducing the event, neither can predictions be made, which can also be tested. Always, though, in the case of Jesus' resurrection, one could reasonably expect his dejected and dispirited followers to become excited and energized by his appearances to them. You go on to say, to my mind, John Loftus and other atheists who contribute to Unbelievable should be challenged to prove beyond reasonable doubt the positive assertion that the entirety of reality is physical in nature, space, time, massa, energy, fields and forces. Until they do so, the great edifice of atheism has no solid foundation. Atheists are atheists because of their inclinations and preferences. Fundamentally, they're no different to religious people. Okay, Eric in Colorado Springs says, Mr. Loftus lives in a world which would be frustrating and unjust. That is, if you could forgive without penalty, there'd be no justice, as forgiveness without penalty sacrifices justice. Michael Ramsden of Arzim has given talks on this very subject. A world without justice would be a world without love. God exacts his love through his justice by the punishment being taken on in the person of Jesus Christ. The price is paid rather than excused. And that's in relation to some of the talk in the second edition of the programme, wasn't it, Eric, in which John Loftus asked why Christ had to come and die in order for God to be able to forgive. Thank you very much. There were, of course, others who felt that John Loftus did a great job. Here's James, who says, while listening to the first part, I kept waiting for John Loftus to make the following case. If we are to believe that a man was resurrected 3 days after his death, then the evidence supporting the claim would have to be pretty concrete. And yet what we have are four Gospels written decades after the supposed event. These four accounts come from a highly illiterate, superstitious culture with no societal taboos on plagiarism or our modern priority on objective history. In short, we cannot be sure who the authors were, if they meant their words to be read as documentary journalism, let alone if they indeed witnessed the event. But even if we accepted the four accounts at face value, it only establishes the fact that four people believed it enough to write it down, not that the stories are true. Great show. Just know this atheist is evangelizing your show wherever I go. Thank you very much, James. No time to make a response to your points, but obviously there are those who believe that the gospel accounts do bear the marks of a historically reliable documents. Joseph in the United States says, Justin, I love your show, so I hope you don't take offense at me saying this, but the last 2 weeks were difficult to get through. My favourite episodes are the ones where the guests on both sides are thoughtful, honest and make interesting arguments. Recent examples would be Michael Roos and Keith Ward and Michael Murray and Phil Harper talking about animal suffering. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but the last 2 weeks with David Marshall and John Loftus were the opposite. While the outsider test for faith is an interesting concept to debate, I wish it could have been with two different guests. I found David Marshall to be misleading with a highly unfair and tendentious reading of history, and John Loftus to be the same on the other side, all anti-Christian spin, as well as being rambling, hard to follow at times, and occasionally kind of a jerk. It was rough, I tell you. Please, I beg, as you select guests in the future, more scholars and interesting thinkers, less apologists and spin doctors. But here's Jonathan Boyd, who thought that David Marshall did a great job. Your last programme on the outsider test was fascinating. I want to comment on two of John's points against the success of Christianity. First, he said that the very people who should have known better, the Jews of the first century, rejected Christianity. I find that argument weak, given the fact many New Testament passages make a special point of explaining why that was the case. I'll cite just one example. The book of Acts ends with Paul under house arrest in Rome. He called together the leaders of the Jews and explained the kingdom of God and Jesus from the law and the prophets. What was their response? They rejected his teaching because it didn't line up with their understanding of the law and prophets. Paul went so far as to quote Isaiah 6 to them about their lack of understanding. Now, if the authors of the New Testament make a special point to explain why the majority of the Jews of the first century didn't accept Christianity, why should their rejection serve as evidence against Christianity's success? Thank you very much. Tim Boyle as well got in touch to say that he thought it was an interesting and well-moderated show. There was general agreement from your two guests that putting one's beliefs to the test is a good thing. Faiths such as Mormonism, with its dependence on a burning in the bosom, are the ones which avoid such testing at all costs. Biblical Christianity isn't afraid of that and, in fact, encourages it. In 1 Thessalonians, it states, "Put all things to the test, keep what is good." In other words, take the outsider test by examining the rationale and objective evidences for what one believes. We're to know what we believe and why we believe it, and that should apply to every set of beliefs, including atheism. But, you say, John Loftus encourages us to be brutally honest, but it doesn't seem like he's really doing that with his own belief system. He simply parroted what people committed to scientism claim about humans evolving from lower animals by random chance, naturalistic means alone, without examining the evidence or lack thereof for such a view. I really like what John Lennox said at a recent event concerning how he responded when one of the new atheists quipped, "Religions are fairy tales for people who are afraid of the dark." He said, "An atheism is a fairy tale for people who are afraid of the light." Yes, let's all take the outsider test and may the best worldview win. Tim Boyle in Japan responding. So there you go, quite a variety of response to that programme. Wish I had time to fit in some of the ones I didn't get time for there. But great to have your interactions, whether they've been online, via email, or by a posted letter this week. So thanks for being with me on the programme. Come back again at the same time next week. I'll tell you what's coming up then.
You're unbelievable.
Paula Gooder, New Testament theologian and scholar, joins me for a Q&A. Send your questions in. We'd be interested to hear from you. And she'll be my guest on a special edition of Unbelievable at the same time next week. Until then, have a good week.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.